Welcome to All the Smoke, a production of The Black Effect and iHeartRadio in partnership with Showtime.
Welcome back, man. Season 2 of All the Smoke.
We got a real special guest.
What's up with your Brody with the virtual handshake?
I'm going to tell y'all something that I never told nobody.
I want All the Smoke.
Welcome back to another edition of All the Smoke. My brother Jack.
What's up, bro?
We got my man Brandon Marshall, 13-year NFL vet. I want to toot your horn a little bit, bro. 6-time Pro Bowler, all pro, only one of 6 players to catch 100 balls in 3 consecutive seasons, and the most yards ever without playing in a postseason game. That part probably got to hurt a little bit, huh?
You was doing so good. And then,
no, but I want to talk because you killed. I mean, damn near 12,500 yards, but you didn't get a chance to play in the playoffs. And obviously, looking back, we're all retired now. And looking back, you kind of look back, and some of the most prominent things to me stick out are playoffs. How tough was it for you never to get over that hump?
You know what? The first half of my career, it was all about me. And, you know, it was, you know, everything I thought about was like, how can I take care of my family? And well, I would say the first year of my career, I was out there having fun. I was excited. And then once I saw the guys around me, you know, living the way they were and taking care of their people, you know, and that's when it shifted for me, like, oh, this is a real business. And my mind shifted to business, but it was from a selfish standpoint. And once I got that contract, and it was the biggest contract at the wide receiver position in NFL history, when I went to the Dolphins in 2010, then I start thinking about team. Like, I mean, I always thought like, oh, if I ball, then the team's going to be better. But like, I literally thought every single day, like, I want to win a championship. I want that confetti coming down on me. You know, I start thinking about the big picture. It drove me the second half of my career, and it kept me up so many nights, bro. And you know, I'm proud of my career, but it is one of those things. It's like, damn, like, I'm gonna live the rest of my life. You know, that's tough, but like, I'm built for it, right? Because like, it came a point in my life where I realized like, okay, you know, football doesn't define me. But at the end of the day, I consider myself an ultimate competitor, and I know how bad I wanted it. And it didn't happen. That was the one goal that I wasn't able to accomplish. Like, I wanted to have 100 catches a season. I wanted to go to the Pro Bowl. It's like, when I put my mind to something, it just happened. So, you like, not making it to the playoffs or the Super Bowl, it's like, how does that not happen? So, it is tough.
You only could do so much, you know, as a receiver, especially in football. It's a team sport. You need everybody to have that same passion. Even with basketball, you need everybody to be on that same page. And football is more guys out there. You might have but 8 guys going 110%, then you got 2 guys that's just half-assing. So you need everybody to have that same mentality to win a Super Bowl, just like an NBA.
100%, bro. Like, well, I don't know. I don't know if I agree with you there. I always felt like in basketball, 1 or 2 guys they dictate the success of the entire team. You know, like, I always felt, even when I grew up playing basketball AAU, I was like, man, if I just go drop 35, 40 right now, we good, and play lights out on the defensive side. So that was always my mentality. Obviously, I ain't make it to the league. I didn't even play in college, so I don't know. But in football, man, it's like, even at the receiver position, like you said, I could be really good at the wide receiver position, but if my quarterback stink, then my career is going to stink. You know what I'm saying? Offensive coordinator, he can't dial it up, then I'm not going to be. Look at Odell Beckham Jr. That's a prime example. Yeah. The last 3 years, and that's my
can't
dog.
Get the ball, like, to him.
I love Odell. You can't get the ball. So why is my numbers better than his at his point in his career when he's the better receiver? He's the better athlete.
I think you made a great point when we came on your show, maybe a month ago. And you and Jack were very similar from this standpoint. And you had a hard time, like, wins obviously were great, but you guys took losses hard, and you took losses a lot harder than other people, and you would have a problem with sometimes with guys just kind of being able to shake losses off. Explain where that competitive nature came from.
It comes from where I'm from. You know, I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and East Liberty, the east side of town. It's the poorest city. It's the poorest county in Pennsylvania. So for me, you know, one, Pittsburgh it's football country, and two, it's a way of life, right? So, like, literally, that was my life. It wasn't a game. It was never a game for me. Like, playing free for all in a parking lot on concrete, like, it was it was serious. Little League, it was serious. So for me, I never had that switch where it was like, okay, when I go on the field, I can turn it on, but when I get off the field, I turn it off. So I think that's why I struggled so much early in my career, because it was all personal. And even till I retired, it was always personal. I was like, yo, this is not a game for me. This is my life. It saved my life. It changed the people around me. And so, like, no, I'm not out here just to put a jersey. I'm not just out here just to, you know, get a bag. Like, I'm out here to really, like, you know, like, this is everything for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You said something interesting earlier. I thought I was the only one, but you guys played tackle football in the street or on the concrete when you was younger too? We used to play that shit in the street. Like, we used to play tackle football in the street, and people are just like, you did what? I'm like, nah, for real. We used to tackle each other because we didn't have no grass to play on. That's what we played at.
Well, hold on. We did the same thing in the South, Matt, but one thing we did, we had grass on the sidewalk, so we only tackled when they was by the curb.
Oh, okay. That was smart.
Yeah. We only tackled by the curb.
We was tackling in the street, but when we were smart enough to where it's like, okay, let me get next to the curb. So if they do, I like that.
Nah, that's crazy.
No, there's some good football in the South, man. Really good football. Some of the best footballs in the South.
Yeah.
So high school, you lettered in three sports. Tell me how track and basketball helped you be one of the most dynamic receivers in the NFL.
Yeah, so everything, when I was six, I just talked to somebody earlier about this. We got a couple young cats that opted out that's training at our facility right now. And I was telling them, I was like, man, everything that I did from the age of six was about making it to the NFL, like literally watching the Pittsburgh Steelers play, sitting there in the living room. I was telling my mom, like, yo, Bobby Foster, you know, like, I should be running the ball right now. Like, I literally thought at the age of seven that I could go pick up that first down or make that touchdown. Like, my mindset was just, it was probably idiotic back then, but that's what it was. So when I got to high school, everything I did was like, how do I get better as a football player? So track was about speed. Like, I wasn't the fastest guy ever. And in high school, I was actually super slow because, like, I had two growth spurts. My freshman year, I shot up to 6'4 or 6'2. And then my sophomore year, I shot up to 6'4. So I was still adjusting to my body. So I was slow. I went from a dominant little league player to high school, you know, not really putting it all together. And track helped me there. And I ended up winning state my senior year in a triple jump, competed in a high jump, went to state, and also the long jump and ran at 300 hurdles. And I could have went to play. Well, not play. I couldn't run, but I could have, you know, did the field events at the next level. Basketball for me, basketball is my first love when it comes to sport. Not like, you know, like hoop dreams type first love. But when you talk about playing the game and competing, I get more angry in basketball than I did in football. Still to this day, right? Like, I love basketball, bro. Like, you know, it's something about the game. It's a beautiful game. And it's like, there's so many moving parts to it, and like, you know, I loved it, number one, but number two, I always felt like it was another way to be conditioned. It was another way to help me develop as a wide receiver. Like, being able to, you know, develop my game above the rim helped me catch the ball deep. Like, I never was a deep threat, so like, I literally would go in the gym and just catch alley-oops, just but picturing catching a post route
in a football,
picturing
right.
100%. And like, utilizing that in the red zone when I got to the league, that's how we would approach it. Like, they would literally tell me, Brandon, go in the league and go in the red zone, be a basketball player, box out.
That's dope. I mean, I'm the exact I'm the same, but the opposite. You know what I mean? You know, although I played 15 years in the NBA, my love is football. You know what I mean? And
that's crazy.
You know, I always thought, like, what would have happened if I would have gave it a chance? You know, because being 6'8 and really being able to play would have been a blessing. So we're on the exact opposite sides of we made a career out of something, but our favorite sport was the other sport.
That's right. But people really know that story, man? Like, you know, I was shocked to hear that, you know, you were one of the best wide receivers in football at the high school level. That's crazy.
Yeah.
I don't think people really know that.
Well, you got to think, too, with us being a little bit older, this is back in 97. You know what I mean? So there wasn't really no, you know, there wasn't no phones. There wasn't no social media. You got to get old film. And I'm working on a documentary right now of oh, wow. you know, a particular part of my high school life. And they shot me a bunch of film of me playing football, highlights of me playing football the other day. And I'm like, damn, I have these one-handed diving catches and going through people, over people, all this kind of shit. So I'm kind of excited to show the world because, wow. like you said, most people don't know because, like I said, there was no real interaction with everyone. You remember back then when we were growing up, like you didn't know about no one until you played against them. You know what I mean? That's right. It wasn't AAU. Right. Like there wasn't no scouting or friends on the other side of the
newspaper.
Country. Like we, right. When
newspaper.
We run into each other. Yeah. Or you know, the couple magazines they had. But when you ran into somebody, it was the first time you really had seen them or played against them because there was no really way to see them on the internet yet.
That's right. That's right. It's crazy yeah. now how, you know, we're so connected worldwide with this. That's crazy.
Yeah. So how has COVID has been treating you and your family? I know you're still able to work, you know, obviously, but how has it affected you and your family, if it has at all?
Yeah, first and foremost, we're all healthy. We're good. So from, you know, my wife and kids got three kids and my mom, my dad, brothers and sisters, everybody's good. Everybody's still here. There's been some people around me that's been extremely affected. I mean, all of us have been affected, but for us to still be here, it's a blessing during these crazy times. But as far as like COVID, man, I just took this time to really just fall back and figure out like, okay, you know, let me put in, do I have the right systems and processes in place to build what I'm trying to do post-career? So I was moving, you know, 100 miles per hour. We were having a lot of success with House of Athlete, brick and mortar, and supplement line. And, you know, this gave me the time to build it so I don't break, you know, 3-4 years from now. So, I'm really appreciative of this time to really fall back. I kept our whole team on, you know, together. We have around like 50 employees. And I just sat everybody down. I said, here's the goal. When we get out of this, we're going to come out stronger. Make sure that we have the foundation in place. I want this thing to scale. This is where I'm trying to do 3 years from now. So I took it on the chin right now, paid everybody's salaries. And I said, look, I want to see systems and procedures. I want to see onboarding process. Make sure the HR department is built right. I want to see the sales process. I want to see operations. I want to see our meeting cycle. How are we going to meet? What's our goal for 2020? What's our goal for 2021? What is the themes of our quarters? Like we really broke everything down and now we're in perfect position to really scale for in 2021.
That's dope. I love that. Well, explain to us what House of Athlete is. I mean, we see the logo behind you. Explain to our viewers and fans what it is.
Well, look, man, we're the healthiest people on the planet. When you look at the wellness industry, right? Like it's a $4.5 trillion industry and we don't participate, right? Like everybody builds their companies off of our lifestyle. Yo, Matt, yo, Brandon, like, look, we need you guys to do this, hold up this product. Yes, things that we take and things that we may use and do, but like, no one has ever scaled athletic performance for the gym pop. And when you look at the healthiest athletes in the world, we do these five things and we do it every single day as part of our routine. We train, we have to be in physical shape, right? So that's a part of it. And you know, there's a way of doing that. The second thing is fuel. We fuel correctly. You got to be able to understand what a healthy veggie is, a healthy protein, a healthy carb, a healthy fat. You got to track your macronutrients. You got to understand supplementation. We know that we want to get all of our food through, I mean, all of our nutrients through food, but it's almost impossible. So that's where the supplement line came in at. We're mentally fit, but that is a tricky one because as a professional athlete, like one day you could be on the side of impairment, dealing with anxiety, depression, or just high stress. You could lose the game, right? You could win the game. So now we're looking at, you know, high performance and just, you know, how do I get more out of my brain, more out of my body? So we got to have a plan for both. And that's what we see the top athletes do. Like we find a way, we figure out it, what, you know, what's going on with our mindset. The fourth thing is recovery. Like, there's a lot of people, man, deal with an MCL injury or some type of ankle injury and they're sidelined for a year or they may stop all physical activity. Well, as a professional athlete, we're back on the court or on the field in 2-3 weeks.
Quick.
So quick. Right? Mm-hmm. No, ain't no crutches. We just had a knee sprain and you back in 10 days playing.
Yeah.
So, you know, recovery is key. And then the last thing is team, is tribe. And that's like none of us got to the top by ourselves. There always was somebody or a few people to help us get there. So community is key. So that's what we're doing, man. We're going to scale athletic performance to the gym pop in a wellness space. We'll open up 43 facilities in the biggest economies in the world. And then our supplement line, I'm looking at the supplement line to be a $200 million revenue generator in 2 years. And we're also launching apparel, just a performance line to compete with the Lululemons of the world. So we're super excited about it. There's a lot of attention. It's something I've been doing since 2012. And now that I'm, you know, owner, operator, and lead in a way the last year and a half, you know, it's something I'm excited about.
I think that's really dope. We don't hear enough about this side of us because we all have different things we're into, but you only hear the typical stuff or the bad stuff, but you never hear how we're trying to better our communities and like you're opening doors for people in your neighborhoods, quote unquote. So I think that's a beautiful thing, man. And best of luck with that.
Appreciate it, man. Thank you. Yeah. I remember when you first retired, you know, there was a few stories about you. And then one of the things caught my eye, I was like, there's something different about this dude. Cause like you were like, yo, I wanna make $1 billion, but I'm gonna do X with it. I'm like, what, Matt? Talk about you wanna do a bill. You're like, what? Do you remember that? You remember that
mm-hmm.
story?
Yeah, absolutely.
As, like, soon as you retired, it was like, Matt, what are you doing now? He's like, mm-hmm. I'm gonna mm-hmm. go invest in these companies. I'm gonna build this. I'm gonna do a billion. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. This boy on something mm-hmm. different.
Well, you mean you gotta shoot for the moon and land on the stars. You know what I mean? And I, like I said, I think too often, and Jack loves to say this, you know, we're able to tell our own stories now. And, you know, you had a certain reputation. Jack and I definitely had a reputation. So anytime we're allowed to step outside of that, people kind of side eye us, not really knowing that we're really on our shit and we are businessmen and we are, you know, everything you thought we weren't post career. And I think too often it really surprises people when there's really a lot of people just like us that are still doing the same thing. It's just never highlighted.
That's right. And one of the things I appreciate about you guys is like, you guys are creating a lane that we all can learn from. You know, you look at what you guys are doing with all the smoke. Like literally, I'm telling y'all right now, I just steal y'all template. I say, what are they doing? I'm doing. So when things start looking the same. No, for real, though. Right. If y'all see anything from my platform looking like all the smoke, like, I'm going to change up the aesthetic, okay?
That's a compliment, bro. That's a compliment. That's a compliment.
People don't understand what y'all are doing and what y'all did and how fast y'all did it. And I'm like, yo, the game is right there. They showing us how to do it, right? So, like, I just appreciate you guys for actually, like, showing us the way. You guys got to pay attention. There's other athletes. Like, we should have been doing this, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Absolutely.
I love what you guys are doing, man.
Appreciate that. Pivoting right now with the current climate of the world and social justice, how do you feel like athletes as a whole, putting us all in one group, have done continuing to carry the message, pushing, you know, we just finished with the elections. How do you feel like athletes have done in this space when no one really wanted us to, they wanted us to shut up and dribble or just play football or do everything but what we're doing right now? How do you feel athletes have kind of stepped up and met the challenge, you know, to kind of do our part to help the country?
Well, I love where we're at right now. You know, I mean, this is what it's about. I go back to 2016 when Cap took his first knee and standing in that locker room and having everybody on the beat and all those cameras in our eyes like, okay, well, what are you guys going to do? We had no game plan. We weren't connected. We weren't on the same page. And I think, that's why we didn't make as big of an impact. So now you fast forward 4 years later, and we're seeing how the NBA took this, brought it all together, used their platform. I know you guys see it differently. Jack, you didn't want to go to the bubble. Matt, you thought it was best to go to the bubble. You know, I'm with Matt, Jack. Like, I just mm-hmm. feel like you guys had a platform every single day to tell the story. And, you know, I would have liked to see the NBA back you a little bit more, you know, because what you did, like, just – I mean, it was just like, I mean, bro, like you really led an entire civil rights movement and you're still leading it. So like for me, like I'm just proud to call myself an athlete, to have a play a small part in it. But overall, mm-hmm. I think the athlete from you, Matt, to you, Jack, to basketball, to football have done a phenomenal job of just keeping it in the headlines every single day.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, unfortunately, your brother, your twin, you know, lost his life. He was brutally killed in the streets. But it's, you know, I would say it's not in vain, because now he's going to save so many lives because of what you stepped up and did. So I'm just thankful that, you know, we came together and we kept the conversation moving forward, because there's a lot of change, man. There's a lot of people still complaining. But for me, I look back, I'm like, look how many things have changed so far in this short time.
Right. We all have a part to do, man. We all doing our part. We all got the same goal. We all headed the same direction. So we all got a part to play.
That's right.
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned it. You know, the NBA was able to bring the bubble and make it a success with nobody getting sick and continuing to press the message. What do you feel like the NFL can learn from not necessarily the bubble, because we know the NFL can't do a bubble, but kind of continuing to empower its players and allowing them to be really voices that are heard? Because there's a lot of superstars in the NFL, but the NFL has never really been as outspoken as the NBA has. What do you feel like the NFL can learn from us?
Everything. I mean, absolutely everything. We're institutionalized as football players, man. You know, and I understand that it's a business. You know, they own the team. But at the end of the day, you know, our platforms are so powerful. And, you know, it's time for the football player, the NFL player, to continue to stand up and speak. Like, I'll be honest with you. When I watched the NBA games, the restart, the playoffs, like, I saw Black Lives Matter. When I watched, and they were talking about it, and then also the people who were covering, the broadcaster, the analysts, they were actually talking about it every single night. After the game, first question, how are you doing? I don't see that in the NFL right now. I see some little messages here and there, but I don't see that. Like, even to give you an example, you know, on Instagram the other day, they said, you know, say their stories. That's not the movement. That's not what we're saying. It's saying say her name, say his name. But see, the NFL, we do this thing where we try to act like we're participating, but we're not really participating. We're just trying to, let's give them enough. You understand what I'm saying?
Check the box. Like, let's check
like,
the box.
What is this? Like, I don't know. I don't know who sat in that room. Even something like, are they doing a better job? Yes, they're doing a better job. I feel like they was forced to do it. But I look at something as simple as that. Like, why do we got to change the name and say, you know, say their stories? I never saw that on a T-shirt. I don't know what that is. I know say her name.
Right.
But it's too controversial, right? It's too political. And I just think sometimes we straddle the fence in the NFL.
I think you hit it on the head, too, because, you know, more likely than not, I'd say the NFL owners, too, but I think your guys' owners stand almost on the exact opposite side of most of the players, you know, of the majority of the players. So when it gets to talking about police brutality, or it gets to talking about the victims of police brutality, you know, these owners are aligned with a president or hopefully a former president soon that sees nothing wrong with it. You know, that sees nothing wrong with what these police are doing. And this isn't a problem that obviously this administration has created, because this has been going on for a long time. But the fact that they don't condemn it is a problem. And it just continues to leave the door open for other issues.
Yeah, I mean, when do we put people over politics? You know, so like, I can look at it, you know, we all made money. And to me, it's like, you know, people want to talk about, well, what about the taxes? Or what about the market? And then it's like, yeah, I understand that, but what about my life?
What about people? You know what I'm saying? I mean, we was lucky. Man. I think too often that people, like, if we're lucky enough to make it out, like you said, but too often, and I'm not saying anyone on here, but sometimes when you make it out and make that money, you forget that you were the lucky one. And there's a whole shitload of motherfuckers just like you that didn't make it out. So that's who we're looking out for. And that's who we're thinking about when we're talking about, are we talking about lives or taxes? Like, come on, man. Are we talking about hate or taxes? Like, to me, there's no comparison. We were lucky enough. And yeah, we all want to keep our money because it was so hard to earn and you have to keep up with stuff. But at the end of the day, we were fortunate to be able to have a savings, to have money to put to the side when the majority of the world doesn't.
And a lot of people don't understand. It's a lot of people that's in the undeveloped state. Like, we so worried about building these buildings and developing the structure and how this place look, but we're not worried about developing the people. And I think once we get back to developing the people and caring about the people more, we'll start going the right direction.
I agree.
100%. 100%. Well, I mean, we'll see what happens in the next couple of hours.
Couple days.
Look, he just got Wisconsin, right, and Michigan. Mm-hmm. So, look like everything, Biden's going to be the guy.
Look out. Look out. Look out. Look out. Question. You know, this is a transition Jack and I made. Obviously, you've made it seamlessly, too. But did you find it strange or difficult to start covering and talking about the NFL at any point post-career?
I'll be honest with you. I never shared this with anybody, only my wife.
Uh-oh. So, all the smoke exclusive. So,
yeah, bro, every time I'm on Inside the NFL sitting next to Ray Lewis, Phil Sims, and we bring in Mike Irvin, and we talk about Hall of Fame, we talk about, you know, championships and all of that, that's when it gets awkward for me. Because that, like, I get angry, you know what I mean? Like, that competitive stuff that we talked about earlier in the show, like, that's still there. So that's the only time that I feel a little weird talking about football. Where, you know, we can laugh and joke about it, but at the end of the day, like, it's not a game, right? So we'll make fun of it. It's almost like the Charles Barkley effect, right? You know, it's like, Charles, like, you never won a championship. You know how Shaq be getting on him. So, like, for me, you know, that's the biggest thing for me when I think about football. Is like, I'm over it. I still probably go out there and catch a couple balls 100%. But I'm over football. I love what I'm doing right now. But it's just the simple fact that I had a goal and I wasn't able to accomplish that. So like, when I see it, it's like, man, I'm still working through that. I got to be honest with you, man. It's, you know, I'm good because I it wasn't like I just start transitioning now. Back in 2014, I spent 3 months with Harvard and Anita Alberce looking at athletes who made that transition and what did they do. And I was preparing there. So I had been on Showtime for 7 years. I opened this up in 2012. We started scaling this in 2014. So, you know, I was already on top of it. But, you know, that's the only thing, man, that keeps me up at night is like, man, like, I never won a big one.
Well, you mentioned Inside the NFL, which is obviously a part of the Showtime family. Jack and I were fortunate enough to come on your guys' show last month. What I thought was so dope was just the chemistry between you guys, between you and Ray talking shit, to Phil Sims talking big. Hey, Phil talks big shit. And then
Phil's
and then
funny, dog.
Hey, Phil is funny because I didn't know. I just knew Phil is a quarterback. I never got a chance to meet him. He's cool, down to earth, talk shits. And then JB will throw a jab in there with his OG self every once in a while. But that dynamic between you and Ray is funny. Talk to us about, you know, obviously your team over that Inside the NFL.
Yeah, man, we approach like it's a locker room, you know, and we've been together for 6-7 years. Like, you know, Ray came in a year later, but like we've been together that long. So the more you're around each other, you know, the chemistry and the continuity just built. So the way we approach it is like we're still competing. Like, I'll come in and I'm like, yo, don't just check the box. Don't just clock in. Like, we going to go win a championship. Y'all won y'all championship. This is my championship. I'm trying to get a sports Emmy. So
talk to him.
It really is that it's the chemistry and it's the continuity. And I think that's what makes a really good show. And we like each other, man. And we're able to push each other, call each other out on certain things, hold each other accountable, which makes even better TV.
Yeah, I think that's been our secret sauce, too, is people. How do you recreate all the smoke? But I think it's the chemistry me and Jack share, that we could talk shit to each other, crack jokes, be back and forth, be mad at each other sometimes, but the love we have for each other never wavers. So when we're in our element, we're unfuckwittable. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I
think that's a t-shirt. That's a t-shirt.
Yeah, thanks.
So who has, up to this point, I mean, obviously no fans, the season's been a little different this year, but there's definitely some teams that are standing out. Are there any teams or players in particular that have stood out or caught your eye by surprise this year?
Yeah, so preseason predictions, I love the thought of what the Steelers could do, and now they stand here undefeated.
Okay, hold on, B. So you mean to tell me, at the beginning of the season, you said that Pittsburgh was going to be undefeated right now?
I'm going to tell you all of my predictions preseason. I'm going to tell you. Well, and yes, to answer your question, yes, Seattle Seahawks. was my team that I picked on Inside the NFL and First Thing First. I said, Seattle Seahawks
come, with facts.
Come out the NFC. I said, Russell Wilson will be the MVP. I said, the Pittsburgh Steelers will be my AFC contender. I said, I also like the Colts as a dark horse. I like the Tennessee Titans, right? So that was my preseason, my preseason pick. Now, also said the Saints will bust. And right now they hanging on. They hanging on. So that was my preseason prediction. For real.
Well, one thing we know, you know football.
Well, hey, it's hard to get some preseason predictions right, but I just think that the Pittsburgh Steelers, I still need to see Big Ben. Sometimes Big Ben revert back to that backyard football stuff and just throwing around. Like, you got a good defense, man. Play smart, protect the ball, throw it away sometimes.
What do you think about the pickup that the Chiefs were able to get? Someone remind me, we can edit this. Who's the running back the Chiefs got?
Le'Veon Bell.
So what do you think about the Chiefs coming off a Super Bowl, coming off Patrick Mahomes, and, you know, he's really doing his thing. What do you think about them being able to pick up Le'Veon Bell?
All right, so let me ask you this question. When you think about the Chiefs, what's the first thing you think about? Like, yo, this team is dope because of what?
Mahomes,
bam, right? So what I love about the Chiefs is that now they're finding different ways to win. We know that Mahomes is dope. We know that he can throw for 400 yards a game, put up 40 points. But now before they added Le'Veon, they was running the ball well. They was winning on defense. They was winning on special teams. To me, they're a better team this year than they was last year because they're more complete. So now you put Le'Veon there. How you go?
Well rested.
2 years.
Well rested too.
What? Yeah, he ain't getting no work. How you go 2 years with the Jets? Almost 2 years with the Jets, and you never had a one rush over 15 yards, and you did it twice in your first game with the Chiefs. Come on, man. He never had one game over 85 yards. This is Le'Veon.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
Think about that. So, you know, is it a nice pickup? Yes. And man, we can talk for another hour about, you know, this topic, because he's also one of the best wide receivers in the game. Like, look at how he runs routes and catches the ball.
To him.
So he can do
talk
everything. This is scary, man. They haven't even, like, really unleashed him yet.
Scratch the surface, right.
Let me ask, hold on. What y'all think about Tampa? Bucks.
I just love it. So we have it right now. I mean, Tom is being Tom, and I just saw, I mean, I'm watching TV as I'm interviewing you, that you saw today was AB's first practice. You know what I mean? So he's out there laughing with the guys. I want to know your thought. I don't know if you personally know him. I know he's had obviously some ups and downs on the field, a lot of downs off the field. I'm glad that he got a chance to kind of redeem himself. I know Tom fought his ass off to get him. What do you think will happen with AB over in Tampa Bay?
I love it.
I think he'll be fine, man. But the reality is, you know, it takes a lot of work, you know what I mean, to grow as a man, you know, and you got to be intentional with it. We know him as the player, right? And I'm not sitting here like I never made any mistakes. Like, I made mistakes, but, you know, in the locker room and on the team is where I grew up. Like, in the locker room is where I learned how to shave. In the locker room is where I learned how to tie my first tie. Right. So I love that he's getting another opportunity, but he got to be able to embrace, you know, his challenges and be better, because we know you as the player, man. Like, just go in there, do your job, get your career back on track, and everything going to be love. It's going to be good. But he got to take a step forward off the field. You know, that's the thing that's been holding him back, obviously.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate, too, because I think some people get caught up in this social media trying to prove stuff to people. Because, I mean, we could walk down this whole situation when he went with the Raiders and then he got on Instagram talking about he wasn't going to do this, this and that, and then got cut and tried to flip it. And the whole, to me, it was just, you know, less was more at that point. You know, you didn't want to be there. You got up out of there, sit back and get ready to go to work. But I think he was addicted to the attention, and a lot of negativity came. And it says a lot about his talent, because people don't get as many chances as he's gotten. You know what I mean? And it's a testament to how fucking talented the dude is. But like you said, you hope he develops as a man, because if there's no development as a man, we're never going to get to see that AB on the field again.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, think about it. After that situation in Oakland, then he went to New England, he kept with the nonsense. He went out and did a whole album, a whole rap video.
Crazy, bro.
Right? So he stayed on that same path. And once they suspended him, he got off of all social media. Now, This is a guy for 3 years, social media has been actually counterproductive for him and pulling him down. And so, absolutely, that's the only sign that he's getting it, is that the last 4 months, he hasn't done anything digitally. And that's hard for him. So yeah, hopefully he started the work. He's still doing the work, and he'll get through this and get his career back on track, his life back on track. And it seems like, you know, everything be good.
I have a question, though. You know, obviously never playing in the NFL. I know plugging in a player in the NBA is somewhat difficult, but there's not as many guys, so he can find his footing faster. How hard is it to be plugged in the NFL because there's so many more players that are on the field?
Yeah, I think it's difficult for a quarterback. Like, if you're asking a quarterback to come in, it's like learning a new language. But a wide receiver, slant route is a slant route.
Right,
it's all
regardless.
About like body. It's like it's probably the same in you know, in all sports, but like it's like body language. You know, when I get to the top of my route, you know, like what indicators am I giving my quarterback that he knows? Okay, let me let it go right now. A slant route's a slant route. A go route's a go route. It's all about me and you get on the same page. And the hard part is, like, it got to a point with me and Jay Cutler. Like, Jay Cutler would just look at me, and I knew what he wanted me to do. I would have a slant route on. He would just look out, give me an eye, and I'll go run a go. Like, we got to a point we didn't have to give any hand signals.
Say
we
nothing.
Had to talk, right? And that's just that chemistry that built over the years. But, like, coming in and being able to, you know, to contribute right away, he'll be able to do that. Look, he did that in a half in New England. Went in there, 54 yards and a half, a touchdown. You know, and then obviously the next week he tweeted and then he was out of there. So Tom and him already have a connection. So that would expedite the process. But I would say that the quarterback position would be the position where it's like, yo, we need some time with him.
It's tough. Gotcha.
But having somebody to have your back, you know, and then not only having your back, it's Tom Brady. You know, you got Tom Brady vouching for you coming to a situation where, you know, you're the best player, probably the best player in the league has your back. And you can come in and just be a professional and try to put everything behind you. I think that's the best situation for him when you got somebody like that. I had that when I had Tim Duncan. I had Tim Duncan to have my back doing when I was right or when I was wrong. So I think that's the best situation he can be in, having the best player in the league behind you. It'll help you make that transformation.
Yeah, and one of the big stories right now around this whole deal with Antonio Brown in Tampa is, like, you know, he moved into Tom Brady's house. So I got a question.
Oh, did he really? Y'all.
Yeah,
that's what's up.
They roommates. He did the same thing in New England, and now it's in Tampa. Have y'all ever had a teammate live with y'all? Have y'all ever lived with a teammate for off season or through a transition period, trade, or anything like that?
I used to. Every time I go to Bay, I stayed in Matt's house. We didn't live together, but I remember a lot of teams I've been on after I was a rookie. Guys that come in that tryout that I was cool with, that I was from my area doing training camp, they stayed in my house.
Yeah, a lot of people don't understand that. We've been talking about that on one of our shows. You know, well, we talked about it this morning, and people are like, "What? Why is he staying with Tom Brady?" I'm like, "Man, like, you guys don't understand. Like, it's a brotherhood. It's like my brother."
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I know one thing I used to try to do was for the holidays, you know what I mean? Because we're always on, you know, Thanksgiving, Christmas, unless you're playing. I was fortunate enough to play a lot of the years in my league, but those holidays are lonely, you know what I mean? So that was one thing I'd always try to do, was I'd always try to have the younger players come to my house, and whether it was my mom cooking before she passed, rest in peace, or we would order food just to kind of have some sort of that family feel, because people think we're athletes and nothing bothered us and it's easy because we got, but we go through all those same emotions, man, of being lonely and missing our family. And like you said, AB, living with Tom to build that chemistry. We're human beings too, first and foremost. And, you know, to try to make it as comfortable and as smooth as possible is the goal, especially with your teammates.
That's right. Yo, yeah. I got it. I know you probably got another question or two, but I got to, like, change topics real quick. Basketball,
yeah, go ahead.
NBA.
Go ahead. What's up?
I got a prediction. Clippers will win it. The Clippers will win it next year.
Shit, I said that this year.
Yeah.
Yep. And he still owes me my 10 push-ups.
Oh, shit.
Hey, bro, clean your.
Tell me why you think that. Tell me why you think that though.
No, B. Cush-ups, not push-ups. Cush-ups.
Oh, cush-ups.
That means you're smoking. Every push-up, you inhaling or exhaling with a joint or blunt in your mouth.
I don't smoke weed, so is that hard?
Oh, yeah, because you got to breathe. You got to breathe. It's tough.
It's tough.
Right, and he got to record it and put it online like I did too.
You know, that's what we got to do. We got to do that. Like, if I decide to smoke, let me stop lying. I tried it before. For about a year. That's how I knew I needed to go get some help, because actually when I smoked, I felt better. And I did that a couple of times. But that's a whole nother story. But if I get back to it, then when we come out to LA, y'all gonna have to.
Man, we got you.
But here, the Clippers. Here's why I like the Clippers. Like, I mean, if he can get back into his rhythm, you know, now we're looking at two of the top. You know, I don't know. Maybe he slid out of the top 10, but you got two of the top 15 NBA players. You know, they can play ball. They play defense. And that's what's missing in the NBA to me now, is you only have like three or four teams in a league that can play defense. And offensively, you got Mr. Consistent, Kawhi Leonard, and I like Paul George. I need a little bit more out of Paul George on the offensive end. And I understand he said I was dealing with a little anxiety, a little depression. Maybe he needed to do some push-ups in the bubble.
Right. He got his mind right.
If he can do some push-ups this offseason, get his mind right, then, you know, we're going to be right there. But here's the problem. Like, and that locker room is divided. Like, you got to know, man, who the superstars is. So if Doc and Lou is saying, if they saying, look, we going to embrace load management, if we going to embrace, like, giving that superstar status, then you either speak your piece at the beginning of the season or you hope you
or
keep your
mouth shut.
Shut
the fuck up.
That's the superstar. So for me, I think Ty Lue's going to do a good job of saying, this is what we doing. And everybody in that locker room, they gotta accept it. If not, they gotta get out of there, because that's what broke that team down. Is everybody got a voice? Everybody. I used to hate that in the locker room. Like, man, if you ain't the superstar, then shut up. Like, I mean, I want to hear your voice. I want to hear your voice. But when it comes to, like, well, why is this guy sitting out?
Don't make it a problem, right?
Why does this guy get to do that? Well, this dude putting up 28 points a game. This dude scoring two touchdowns a game. Like, That's what happens.
Yeah. That's why. Well, I think one thing about Ty Lue is Ty Lue's an excellent communicator, you know, and being in that locker room before, and him being an assistant coach, and knowing that the Lob City's biggest weakness was ourselves. You know, we had a talented enough team to definitely win a championship, and we butted heads too often. And that didn't rear its head for the Clippers until later, and then after the season, where people were chirping, well, I didn't like this, or so-and-so shouldn't have been. And I'm just like, damn, like, that's – I thought we was way past that as professional athletes, but I guess we weren't. One thing I also wanted to touch on, too, was, you know, you're big and have been speaking and outspoken on mental health. And that was the one thing when I got a chance to talk to PG while he was in the bubble, was he was dealing with some mental health and anxiety and depression and separation. How serious is this? Because as Black men, first and foremost, and as Black athletes, it was looked down before as almost a weakness to talk about issues you had. Obviously, we're past that, and it's more talked about these days. But what is your take on it, being someone that has suffered from it?
You know, I'm glad that you went back to that, because, like, you know, although I was making fun of the whole Clipper situation and that whole restart, but there was a lot of guys, you know, struggling in that bubble. And there's guys in the NFL struggling right now. So, it's not a game. It is serious. But, like, that's why I talked about, you know, marijuana, is because when I was playing for the Dolphins, that's when I realized something was going on. And marijuana was the thing that got me through that year. Like, that was the first time I was able to smile again and feel again. And then, you know, I got to the off season. And I went to McLean Hospital, And I was there for 3 months in an outpatient program. I was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. The best way to describe it is like an emotional disorder, being able to self-regulate your emotions, right? Long story short. I took dialectical behavior therapy. That's a group therapy. I took mentalization therapy. I took self-assessment. One-on-one with Dr. Gunderson, I did a clinical evaluation, neurological evaluation, just to see what was going on in my mind. And I was put in this program, and it changed my life. And there's so many of us that deal with, I mean, this life is hard, you know, and if you don't have a game plan around how you're going to deal with stress, that stress can turn into a mental health challenge, a mental health issue for you. It may not be bipolar. It may not be borderline. It may not be anxiety. But if you don't correct these things, then it can definitely hit you and hit you in a major way. So, you know, even now, like now we got people dealing with anxiety and depression for the very first time. So I just think that, you know, for me, I appreciated Paul George saying it, you know, because there's a lot of athletes dealing with anxiety. There's a lot of athletes dealing with depression or understanding, being comfortable with who they are in this big space. So, you know, now you got the Kevin Loves of the world. You got the Dak Prescotts of the world really using their platforms to talk about it and highlight it. We still talk about it wrong in the media. You saw what Skip Bayless did after Dak Prescott came out.
Asshole.
So, you know, there's a long way to go, but I love where we're at right now. And once again, led by the athletes. So it used to be a taboo topic.
Not to press too much in your personal life. Is this something that's ongoing, or did you get it fixed when you win, or is this still a daily battle for you?
Yeah, no. So like now it's interesting, you know, because there's so many ways it can present itself. There, you know, mental health can present itself in over 300 different ways with just one diagnosis. So for me, going through that process really gave me the skills and tools I needed to self-regulate. So, you know, I could be in a moment and I'm like, well, what tools, what skills do I have to regulate? You know what I mean? To manage this? Can I make it better? You know, do I want it to stay the same or make it worse? So what I do now, and I'll go back to my last years in football. So what I did in the football season, I had a game plan. I knew that was the most stressful time of the year for me. So every week I would sit down with a mental health practitioner. Before practice, I would jump in a float pod. After practice, jump in a float pod. Like, I was very intentional daily in my mental fitness.
Routine.
In the off season, what I do is as needed. So I'll probably like once a month check in with a mental health practitioner, or I might check in with a family member or a friend. Just like, yo, how you doing? He or she checking on me. But part of my daily routine, because I feel like you need to make deposits because something's going to happen, right? Like who would have known this year would have turned out the way it is? Like did you have the deposits to be able to be strong enough through this? So meditation is big for me. Being able to recover, get away, turn off at night, you know, shut my brain off is important for me. So those are things that I do every single day to make sure I'm making those deposits. So when those stressful moments come up, I'm good. I'm ready to go.
I think the key you said, if anyone takes away the tools you need to handle each situation, because we're not equipped with them. We weren't raised with them. It wasn't something that was talked about. Showing emotion in our culture was a sign of weakness, no matter who you were, from a child to stop fucking crying to an adult. You know what I mean? So now that we're in a space that we can comfortably talk about it, it's the tools, like you said, that you learned from handling, doing your counseling that were allowed you to get through the process. And not enough of us have that tool. I was fortunate. I came from a, you know, functioning drug addicts. My parents were functioning drug addicts, very abusive household. So I found marijuana at 14 and smoked it from 14 to this day. And that was really, at the time, I didn't know what it was. I just knew it was an escape for me. And as I got older, I realized, okay, damn, I can focus. I can sleep better. A lot of different things are coming from this. So that's why I was so glad when the medical research finally caught up, because I could have said everything it made me do until I was blue in the face. But until there was medical backup, medical research saying, okay, well, it does A, B, and C, just like these guys are saying it was doing, it wasn't doing any good. But I think if I didn't have cannabis, no bullshit, who knows what kind of deep end I would have went off of, because, you know, my life off the court was very well documented. I was in a lot of shit off the court. But, you know, to be able to be on TMZ and all these blogs and then have to play on ESPN that night, that focus is essential, you know, no matter what the fuck is going on in your life for that 2 hours, 2.5 hours, whether it's on the football field, the basketball field, there's no excuses. And my outlet has always been cannabis. So I'm very thankful now that, like I said, the medical research is catching up, because I know a lot of these athletes, like you said, whether you use it or not, we need some sort of tools to deal with this shit, because people think we're invincible because we have money, but that's the furthest thing from the truth.
Yeah, so is that why you're so passionate in investing in this space?
Yeah, I believe in it. You know what I mean? I'll be the first one to tell you, I enjoy getting high. I like the way it feels, but I'm more on the educational side. Like, I'm not a Snoop. I'm not a rapper. I mean, it's okay to kind of glorify it in that aspect, but I'm coming from an aspect of a former player, a father, and someone who coaches my kids right now. So I'm coming more on the medical side and understanding, trying to remove the word high and explain the medical benefits of it and the way it makes me feel. And I think that's where we're finally starting to make headway, because whether they like it or not, whether they keep finding us a lot of professional athletes use it, and we shouldn't be penalized for it. Draft day 2006, what's going through your mind?
Man, 2006 draft day. I literally thought, like, I went to UCF, and we were mid-major back then, playing in the MAC conference, just switched to Conference USA. And in my mind, I felt like if I ran well as a big wide receiver, I could have snuck into the first day. So back then, you know, they did the first three rounds day one. So I was sitting there stressed out, in the third round, thinking that I had an opportunity to go, and it didn't happen. And it was the longest night of my life. You know, I was super stressed out. And then the next day, I ended up getting drafted to the Denver Broncos. And what's interesting behind that, they actually drafted me as a tight end. So Coach Shanahan, when he called me, they were like, yo, you know, we don't know if you can play wide receiver. Just be ready to play H-back when you come in. And at that point, I was like, man, just give me an opportunity. I'll show you what I can do.
So you hit the ground running, from 2007 to 2009, three consecutive 100-season catches. What was it like after what you explained to us, they weren't sure you could be a wide receiver, to come out and experience so much success early on in your career?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I said, that first year was about having fun and just enjoying being in the league. And the second year, Javon Walker, we just paid Javon Walker a lot of money to be our number one receiver. He went down with a knee injury. So when he went down, I just stepped up. And Jay was just throwing me the ball. Like, Jay was like, I'm dropping back, I'm throwing to Brandon. And it just took off. So that actually set the bar for me. Like, I didn't really have any expectations when I got in the league. I knew I wanted to be great. But when that first 100 catches, I was like, well, I guess I'll do this every year. So that became my goal.
Right.
My goal was that's the bar right there.
Mm-hmm. Who were some of the receivers you studied on? In the process of becoming a pro, leading up to the pro, and even after you got into the NFL?
Yeah, so I looked at everybody. Every year I would take the top 10 wide receivers, and I would break down all their film every year. And then also throughout the year, I would keep up with their film, because, you know, I don't know if y'all have this in the NBA, but I can see every single play, every single snap from every angle, all 32 teams. So I would take that, and I would have our video guy just build out my film. So I'll be on the plane, I'll be watching our games and studying myself, studying our opponent, and then also studying everybody else. So back then it was Chad Ochocinco, it was T.O., it was Marvin Harrison, Reggie Wayne. Who else was balling back there? Randy Moss, Steve Smith, Larry Fitzgerald, Andre Johnson. I was studying those cats. I got, you know, that was that wave before me. Anquan Boldin was one I was studying, you know.
Megatron.
Well, Megatron came after me but eventually he became that part of that top 10 when he came in a couple years later, 100%. That's when I start really studying my body type.
I was about to say, you guys are similar, right? You guys are similar in body, right?
Bro, he's like you, bro. Like Megatron, yeah. I got a picture. Yeah, man. Like, you know, Megatron is like your size.
He's big.
It's crazy. What? And he moving. So think about, I don't know how fast you were when you was playing. back then, you know. But
I ran a 4.39.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's insane. I can't wait for this documentary.
Hey, you touched on something that I don't think everyone understands, and you may not get to understand it if and when you get to the league, but how important is film study, not only of yourself, but your opponent and your environment? Because I think that's something that people don't get. And I didn't get maybe my first handful of years into the league. And I, you know, myself and Jack, you know, Jack was a little bit more more offensively minded than me, but we always had to guard the best players. And film was so crucial to me. So how important is film for an athlete?
It's everything, man. It sets you up for success. And I think that's the hardest thing to do, is actually learn how to watch film, how to break down opponents. That was the hardest thing for me. I give you, you know, a cool story. 2016, I believe it was, when I was playing for the Jets, battling against the Patriots. We go up to Foxborough the first game, and this is probably my best year. I'm on pace to have 1,500 yards, 15 touchdowns, another All-Pro year, Pro Bowl year. And, you know, I look at the roster, I'm like, who's this Logan Ryan cat? And then they got another DB on the other side. I'm like, oh, I'm gonna have a day. But Bill Belichick always finds a way to take out their top wide receivers, their top threats, like that number one, number two. You hear about it every single week. Oh, this is what Bill Belichick's gonna do. So I step in and I'm like, oh, you know, this is gonna be easy for me. They're playing me man to man. And when I tell you I was strapped, I mean, strapped, bro. Like, I couldn't get off the line of scrimmage. And this is a dude, I'm like, I don't even know this dude's name at the time, like this Logan Ryan cat. And so the first quarter, I couldn't get off. I'm struggling. And I'm like, man, this dude's embarrassing me. And then one time I come out and I'm on the right side, and I so happen to put up my right foot, right? So if you're on the right side of the quarterback, 9 times out of 10, you're going to see that receiver put, as you know, that left side foot up. Mm-hmm. So I put my right side out, just, I don't know what I was thinking. And then
helped you get out of your stance. Yeah.
He's looking at my feet. And then he turned around and looked at McCourty. They did some little hand gestures, bro. And I was like, holy crap. Like, is this a tendency? Is something that they study? Mm. And they study everything in New England, right? Mm. So anyways, I start playing with my feet. And then depending on which foot was up and what my split was, determined how they played me. And that's why I couldn't get off the jam, because I was given a tendency, right? Mm-hmm. Fast forward, we played New England twice. We come back around, and I'm breaking down film for like a week. I'm watching. I'm like, man, what is my tendency? Like, what are they seeing, and how can I use this? So literally, I figured it out. I remember running out. It was like 6 in the morning, 7 in the morning. I ran out my room, and me and Fitzpatrick was the only ones in the facility around that time, and the coaches, right? I ran in the quarterback's room. I'm like, yo, I figured it out. Here's the game plan. All you got to do is watch the guy over me, and it's going to dictate what they play. I ran into Coach Bowles' office, who's now the defensive coordinator in Tampa. I was like, Coach, man, look at this. Here's the tendency. This is how they stopped us week one, the first time we played, and this is what we need to do. And so literally the game plan going in was, all right, let me look at Brandon. If the dude is 3 yards off of Brandon, they're going to go 3 bail. Right. And basically that is, you know, this corner has this third, the safety has this third, this corner has that third. And when I say we lit it up, bro, we lit it up. Like, we knew everything they was doing based off of how they played me. If he was 3 yards off him, if he was on, if he was inside, if he was outside. And so, man, they I went for 100 something yards. Eric Decker went for 100 something yards. So I say all that to say film study is critical. Mm. And something as critical as that, like, we give tendencies. And then also, like, when you know what you're doing, you can really dominate a game just off of your film.
Mm-hmm. That footwork, that footwork, that line footwork and getting off the line is crucial for people who've never played or understood the meaning of that wide receiver position. That's just important. December 13, 2009, you set an NFL record with 21 catches. What do you remember about that day? That's a lot of catches.
Oh, you was on one.
Yeah. So
you had that Bruce Leroy glow. You had that Bruce Leroy glow that day.
So I used to try to put together a mindset going into a week. And remember 2009, I don't even know what album Hov just dropped, but Jay-Z just dropped an album. And in my head, I was like, back then I was like, I'm gonna embrace my inner Jay-Z. And you know, what I loved about Jay-Z back then was, like, how he moved. It was, like, effortlessly, right? Like, it was, like, I'm supposed to do this. So I went, you know, I was rocking, you know, I was jamming to his album. I don't remember which one that was. And I walked out, and then Smith, one of the ESPN reporters, was standing right there. And I was like, yo, bro, this is going to be the best game I've ever played. Mm. And I said, just remember I said this. So then we fast forward, we get into the game, and you know, I was just catching the ball. I was just balling. I was embracing my inner Jay-Z. I would catch a ball, I would get up, just flip the ball to the ref, had my head down, somebody trying to talk to me, I don't hear you. And I think I was around like 18 catches. I remember Kenny McKinley came, sat next to me on the bench. He's like, bro, he looking at me. Where I'm like, bro, why are you staring at me like this? He said, bro, you got 18 catches. I said, what? He said, you got 18 catches, bro. You about to break the NFL record. I said, boy, why you ain't been telling me this? So I was in the zone, man. Like, I called it, which is crazy. And then I just remember being in that, like, that zone. We always talk about that as an athlete. Like, man, like, I don't even remember what happened. I was so locked in to just balling that, you know, I didn't even know I had those many catches.
That's dope. In that zone, for real. You're traded from the Broncos to the Dolphins in 2010. Earlier in the interview, you said that you and Jay Cutler just had looks, because that's what kind of chemistry you had. So you went with Chad Henne for 2010, Matt Moore for 2011. You had 1,000 yards both seasons. How tough was it developing chemistry after having such great chemistry over in Denver with Cutler?
Yeah, that was the hardest thing, man. And it's crazy because I used that story to talk about Odell and his situation in Cleveland this past 2 years. But for me, you know, like, I made my money just beating man-to-man coverage. And that was our offense in Denver. It was, you know, Jay and I just took it, and the coaches just said, all right, we're going to develop our offense this way. Like, one day we went out there, and it was, you know, I was single, backside, one-on-one. We didn't like it. Jay looked at me. He gave me a go route. We connected. And then we came back. They did something else. He gave me a slant. We connected. Came back. They gave me a look. I said, Jay, let's run it out. We ran it out. We connected. Come fast forward to that Monday morning meeting. Jeremy Bates was like, I don't know what the hell you guys are doing, but I like it. So we would put plays in. We would say, front side, you got to play. Jay and Brandon, y'all figure it out when y'all get out there.
Right.
We would literally call, you know, trips right, Z, Zing, bingo.
What, were you the Z or the X?
X hand signal. I was X.
Okay.
So I was backside. So they would say X hand signal. That was the play. So we would go out there and figure it out. Right? Mm-hmm. So now you fast forward to going into Henne. And that was really frustrating for me, because I'll be one-on-one and he wouldn't even look my way and throw me the ball. He would be going through his progression. I'm like, this is why you
get
guys
the money.
Paid me.
Get to the money. That's why I came here.
Because of that. Yeah. So that was frustrating, man.
How long did it take for you? Did you guys develop that at all or nah?
Chad Henne, Matt Moore, Tyler Thigpen. Chad Pennington.
Who?
You went right.
Who? I'm going to sound like an owl in a minute. Who?
So I love playing with Matt Moore, by the way. Matt Moore actually would throw it to me. Like, he was like, yo, I'm just going to drop back. If you're one-on-one, I'm throwing to you. So that was cool. He was a little limited at quarterback, but I love playing with him. But no, we never developed that. And it wasn't until, like, you know, my second year in Miami, I remember watching Sunday Night Football and seeing Jay Cutler just being smashed. And he was probably getting hit every time he dropped by back. And I just hit him up like, bro, man, you all right, man? I'm watching this, man. Keep your head up. And then we just start talking. Yeah, we just start talking. It's like, hey, why don't you come to Chicago? I was like, man, I ain't asking for no trade, bro. I'm just going to pray on it and see what happened after the season. But I would love to come ball with you. That offseason, man, they called me. And they were like, hey, you know, Chicago want to trade for you. Jay stood on the table, just like,
hell yeah.
Tom Brady stood on the table for AB, and they brought me in. Jay was like, I need an X. Go right. You know, I went right to Chicago, and we picked right up where we left off.
I mean, you came in with the monster. You're 118 receptions, 1,500 yards, and 11 touchdowns. It notched your sixth 1,000-yard season. I mean, how did that feel?
It felt good because, like, I was that was the first time I listened to the media. It was my last year when I was playing for the Dolphins. You know, I went from, like, back-to-back-to-back, 100-yard, 100-catch seasons, Pro Bowls back-to-back. And, you know, that was the first time, like, the newspaper clipping, I was reading it. And I was struggling. and I didn't have amazing numbers like 80 catches here, 80 catches there, three touchdowns, four touchdowns, whatever it was. So what I end up doing is I took all the clips of all my drop balls, and I would go home after practice and I would literally catch 20 of those, like, in that same position.
Types of catches.
Mm-hmm. So like we played in San Diego and I was running down the left side of the field. It was like, I would have been like a 77-yard touchdown, but I lost the ball in the lights. And I was like, dang. So I went home, I put the lights on my basketball court, and I had my trainer throw it up in the lights. And I would track the ball coming out of the lights. Mm-hmm. And so what I did is I took all those catches and I just kept working on it, working on it. Fast forward, it didn't happen that next year. I mean, it didn't happen that year, didn't turn it around, because I was trying to ball, finish out the season strong. But then that next year is when I had that 118 catches, man. And you know, it felt like I ain't dropped anything. So that's what I remember from that season, was how I put that work in the year before and how it ended up panning out, you know, in Chicago.
That sounds like some Kobe shit. They said Kobe missed was it a free throw or a jumper? I don't know if it's urban legend, but they said he worked one summer with just a bunch of lights right in his face so a camera flash would never fuck with him again.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, you learn a lot as an athlete, you know, when you're in those moments. And from that play, like, what I would start doing is actually before the game started, I would walk the entire stadium to find any blind spots. You know, so I don't know if y'all ever had a moment where you're like, man, if I knew this was happening, I could have prepared better.
Avoid it. Mm-hmm.
Change your preparation. For me, it was like before the game, I would walk the stadium and look at everything, every inch of the grass, if there was any divots, any blind spots.
Mm. You were paired with Matt Forte that year. Very solid offense. You guys ended up going 10-6, but not making the playoffs. How disappointing was that? Because, like you said, you came out with the monster year. You're reunited with probably one of your favorite quarterbacks you played with during your career. Matt Forte was in his bag, and you guys still fell short with a 10-6 record. That's, I mean, most of the time, 10-6, 85-90% of the time, that's a playoff record.
So, you know, you guys know how it is, man. Like, you put so much work into it, and we talked about this earlier, like that mindset of, all right, now I shift from, you know, getting that contract to now winning the Super Bowl. And everything I did was for that moment. So, like, I was so locked in every waking moment. And for us to lose, it was devastating. I remember we end with a Minnesota Viking loss. So as we led, we played Detroit, we beat Detroit, we handled our business, we fly back to Chicago, and we're on a bus heading to Lake Forest to headquarters, and we're watching the game as we're going, and we just need Minnesota, I believe, to win. I believe it was for Minnesota to win, and they lost. And they lost, and all of us just like, ah. You know, Lovey Smith was fired after that year. They let go of a few key players, Brian Urlacher, and nothing was the same since in Chicago.
Did it ever wear on you? Obviously, you said it's something you still think about, but it did wear on you off the field, your attitude towards your family or your friends or your mental approach. Did the lack of being able to get to the playoffs in your job wear in your personal life?
No, I think my just my dedication wore on my family. And that was part of, you know, where I had to find balance. You know, that's part of that whole mental health journey too, man. My second anniversary, I went to Whole Foods, bought my steak, non-hormonal steak, all my seasoning, my pots and my pan, because, you know, the bed, you know, they talk about different type of, you know, things in pans. Like, I was just on this health kick. So I go down to Prime 112 at 4 o'clock that day. And I'm like, look, I'm coming for my anniversary, but here's my food. This is how I want you to prepare it. Like, bro, I was that wow on my preparation, how I took care of my body, that it just, I didn't have a life outside of ball. That's all I wanted to do, was just be great. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. To the point, and I always use that as an example, because I'm like, damn, looking back on it, that was crazy. Like, one day in an off season, One day in the offseason, I can't just go to Prime 112 and say, you know, cook me, give me your filet mignon. Like, I went to Whole Foods, made sure it was non-hormonal, gave them my seasoning, my pants, right?
Crazy.
That shit is classic.
My wife looking at me like, yo, you crazy, man. You need
help.
What
the hell is wrong with you?
How did the inside the NFL opportunity present itself?
Oh, man. Well, you see... So just studying, like I said, spent 3 months with Anita L. Bursay, the Harvard class, and just studying like how guys transition. And Magic Johnson, Liv Strong stood out to me, Boomer Esiason, Doug Flutie, like a couple guys stood out to me that did well with their platform. And so after we got out of that case study, I put a game plan together. It was like 2014. I said, okay, let me do it now so I can actually make that transition seamlessly. So I said, every year I'm going to go on tour. I'm going to go out to Bristol, get on ESPN. I'm going to go out to LA, do some of the lifestyle stuff. But I want to meet the executives. I want to meet the producers. I want to get the reps. So when I'm ready to move on, it's already set up. So the first time I went on tour, I called it going on tour. CAA hit me up, WME hit me up, all these agents hit me up. I didn't even know you needed a broadcasting agent. I thought my football agent was going, you know what I mean, be the guy to do my TV deal. So all these agents hit me up, and Josh Pyatt from WME, he's like, look, I love what I just saw. Let's work. So literally, you know, a week later, he's like, all right, there might be an opportunity for you to go on Showtime inside the NFL, be the first active athlete doing full-time broadcasting. So that's how that came about. And that's one of the reasons why the Chicago Bears shipped me out of there. It's like,
I was
going to
get to that. Yeah, I was going to get to that. So they had an issue with you doing stuff in the offseason, obviously?
Not the offseason, in season. What I was doing was, so you know, in the NFL, every Tuesday, it's pretty much universal that guys are off.
Off, right.
So everybody's off. That's your off day. Do whatever you want. Take care of your body, but just chill. So we shoot inside the NFL on Tuesday.
In New York. That's right.
Uh-huh. So I would wake up at like 4 a.m. The PJ would leave 5:30 a.m. I would leave from actually like Indiana. It was 45 minutes away from the city of Chicago. Take off, land in Teterboro. From Teterboro, we would be on, you know, we'll shoot to the city. I'll be on set around 10:30. We would start shooting from 12 at 12. At 12 to 2:30, we shooting. At 4 o'clock, I'm back at Teterboro. I'm landing in Chicago at 5 o'clock, right? So that was my days on Tuesdays. And they didn't like that. They thought it was a distraction. And I'm like, I just went for 1,500 yards. Like, why is it a distraction? You know, so the new regime, when they came in, they were like, look, it's either you stop doing this or else. And I was like, well, you know, I'm going to keep moving forward, because then it got back to what we talked about early, like just being institutionalized. I'm like, I got once in a lifetime opportunity to do something, build something bigger than a game of football. I said, I'm still balling. I said, what's more of a distraction? Me talking shop on Tuesdays on Showtime about football? Or me going to the club every night, coming in drunk.
Right. Pick and choose.
It was more of a distraction to the team.
Talk to them. It's that bullshit business side of everything. How dope was it, though, to be able to actively be playing in the NFL, doing your thing, but still being able to talk about the rest of the league on Tuesdays?
It was challenging, bro. I absolutely hated it because, you know, it was like a art to it where – I could, like, hell. I wasn't even watching all the games, so I couldn't even really. I had to finesse it because I didn't really know what was going on. I knew my matchups. I knew, you know, what teams I was playing against. So it was challenging because, you know, we never want to, you know, give bulletin board material. So it was a way of trying to entertain without saying something crazy. Like, now I get on there, like yesterday on First Things First, I'm like, this is the worst year Bill Belichick ever had. He's the GOAT, but he's terrible. He's having a terrible year, right? Like, I would never say that when I'm playing, because then it's going to be a distraction to the team.
Absolutely, props.
You know,
so you couldn't speak your truth. You couldn't speak your real truth.
I can't crush Baker Mayfield. Yeah, like I couldn't go up there and say Baker Mayfield is a bust. I do it now, right? But like I tried to do it where, you know, I was still entertaining, but I wasn't creating major headlines that could be a distraction to the team.
Right, right. So you end up with the Jets in 2015, have another monster season, 109 receptions, 1,500 yards again, 14 touchdowns, led the NFL. What was it like, first and foremost, going to the Jets, but then playing in the biggest media market in the world?
You know, that was the whole plan, man. Like, I just, you know, I felt like being there, I could extend, you know, my time on Showtime and then obviously get an opportunity to win. Like, I felt like we were a quarterback away. For some reason, I thought Geno Smith could develop. I didn't think he would get it year one, but I thought our second year together with Todd Bowles, that it could happen. To me, it was the, you know, I was getting the best of both worlds. Off the field, I was exactly where I wanted to be. On the field, I felt like we had an opportunity to compete. We went back and got Darrell Revis, Antonio Cromartie. The defense was you know, on paper, was supposed to be really good. They were really good that first year. And offensively, I thought I was the difference maker. I thought, you know, if they used me correctly, that we would be good enough to win ball games and make some noise.
Who was the one quarterback during your career you wish you got a chance to play with?
I played with him, but it was too late. Russell Wilson. You know, Russell,
with them,
you know,
at like the Russell, end.
Bro, yeah, because that's my style. It's like, just give me a chance. Like, Russell, one-on-one, I'm coming to you. And and I also like that setup in Seattle where they're going to run the ball, which gives me favorable matchups outside one-on-one. But Russell Wilson, I just love how he played. He extend plays where, you know, the play is never dead. He's going to get out the pocket, keep running, keep going, try to find a way to get open. I'm throwing the ball. So he was that guy. But if, you know, another guy, you know, I would have enjoyed playing with would have been like Aaron Rodgers, you know, obviously Tom Brady the GOAT. But I love those guys because it's still a little bit of backyard football, like one-on-one, you know, like
slaying that thing,
you know, and then also look out there, run a slant, go out, you know, off scripted plays.
Favorite DB to match up against or who you love talking shit to?
So, Champ Bailey, I practiced against him, and then, you know, he was on my team in Denver, and then we played against each other when I went to Miami. Champ Bailey was a dog. He was my hardest matchup. He was one of the reasons why I developed. And then also, Darrell Revis was hand down probably the hardest matchup. Like, this dude had a stretch where nobody went over 100 yards. We're talking about Randy Moss, Reggie Wayne, Andre Johnson, Chad Ochocinco, you name it, Larry Fitzgerald, Megatron. Nobody could get off on this dude. So
Revis Island.
Bro. Yeah, he was.
Randy Moss did burn his ass and catch him one hand.
That was one. He had a hand on that play. And then after that play, he pulled his hamstring and he was out.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was a hamstring. I just think his pride was hurt.
Hey, on a serious note. March 2018, you partnered up with Logic, Glenn Close and his wife, to start a group called Can You Relate? Can you explain to us what that was about?
Typically, we have our first break from the age range of 18 to 22. 18 to 22, where we're at on college. We're in college. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what we focused a lot on during that time was how do we bridge the gap between our college students and mental health and them understanding what services they had. So what we did is we actually put together an entire week where we brought out Logic and some other folks to really highlight mental health and have that discussion. You know, a lot of people don't understand. It's like, man, I've been good all my life and now I'm having this first, what is this I'm feeling? Well, that's anxiety. And they don't even know what it is. They feel like they're dying. They feel like they're having a heart attack, but the reality is anxiety, depression. You know, the sense of, you know, am I worth it? You know, you come from a place where you're the best person in your class, the best person in your sport, and now you're in a pool full of people that's talented. So there's a lot that happens on the college campus, and I just think it's important for us to give our college students resources that they need to deal with these mental health challenges.
That's dope. All right, we're quick hitters now. This is the end of the show, so I'll take the first one. Who are your top five artists?
Top five artists, I got to go with Jay-Z, number one. I love Biggie. I love Rick Ross. And we talking about rap, right?
Yep.
All right, so Jay-Z, we're going to go with Biggie. We're going to go with Rick Ross. We're going to go with, you know, ooh, man, five? You need five?
Jack threw Michael McDonald in there last week, so feel free to stray outside of rap as well. You need to.
Oh, yeah, you tripping. Oh, yeah, you tripping. You know, I said, let me go some new school right now. So new school, you know, I like listening to the Baby. He's cool. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm going to go back to Pac, too. Like, man, this is a legend. Mm. I still listen to Pac all the time. Like,
yeah.
Pac is one of those dudes where, you know, you can lift weights to it, and also you can sit back and vibe to it. So I love listening mm-hmm. to Pac in so many different ways.
And fight to him. And that motherfucker had a song for every emotion, every human emotion that was given to us.
Yeah, Pac, man. Pac was
speaking of Pac and you're working out, give me three songs on your training playlist.
So three songs on my training playlist right now. I'm listening to, this is sound crazy, but Fetty Wap got a joint from 2017 that I just found. So Fetty Wap got a joint called A that I'm listening to heavy right now.
Hey.
Yep. T.I. got a, what is it? T.I. just came out with something
his last project was nice.
Yep.
His last project was nice.
That shocked me. And, man, what else am I listening to? So those are the top. Those are two that's on rotation. And then also, what's the kid out in Detroit?
Big Sean.
Big Sean got a few projects out right now. A few joints out now that I'm rocking.
Big Sean album is hot.
And then
Big
Pop Sean Smoke can go. Too. I'm still listening to Pop Smoke.
Hey, I didn't, with all due respect, rest in peace. I didn't really know too much because I haven't really given, there's a handful of these young boys I listen to, but that Pop Smoke album, you got to give your hat to him. And then 50 did a great job producing that shit, man. That was a hell of an album.
Shout out 50 Cent, man, for sure.
And I know, you know, like I ain't even know nothing about Nipsey for real. So that hustle, that I still listen to that as well.
Hustle and Motivate.
Hustle and Motivate.
Yeah,
Hustle and Motivate, that joint go hard. That's always like I snowboard too, so like I listen to a lot of Nipsey when I snowboard.
Is that right? That's dope. Well, what got you into snowboarding? I would have never expected that.
Bro, y'all gotta go. You might be too tall. Y'all
Al,
might be
too tall. Al snowboard. Nah, Al snowboards a lot. Al bigger than ball of us, and he snowboard all the time.
I just remember Sonny Bono. Y'all can have that snowboard, and I just want to know what got you into it.
Yeah,
I'm cool.
I don't know, man. Like, I was out there playing in Denver, and that's where I went and got my surgery. I had three hip surgeries in Vail, Colorado, and everybody would ski, and I never got it. So one trip, my wife is like, you know, I want to go ski, and I want to try. And I was like, all right, I'll be down at the bottom of the mountain. Then the next trip, she finally got me to just, you know, take a class, and I fell in love with it, bro. I was just like,
that's dope.
Forget the instructor. I'm going to fall my way down the whole slope and figure it out. And we've been snowboarding. Like, my kids start snowboarding at three. They five now. Three-year-olds that's going dope. Down the mountains, going down greens and blues.
I don't snowboard or ice skate because black people been skating on thin ice their whole life, so I'm cool.
This dude is stupid. Back to the question. Who is your wide receivers of Mount Rushmore?
Yeah, I'm going to go with... Go ahead and put yourself up there, man.
We know you're going to...
No, I ain't going to do that. I'm going to get the OGs out the way. Jerry Rice. There's a couple of them. Jerry Rice, T.O., Randy Moss. You know, and then like some new school dudes, Julio Jones. I think he's going to go down as one of the greatest. Larry Fitzgerald, Anquan Boldin, Andre Johnson. But if I had to just give the top five, Jerry Rice, Randy Moss, Terrell Owens, Julio Jones, Megatron.
That's a tough list. Five dinner guests, alive or deceased. Just your five dinner guests you want to have dinner with, alive or deceased.
You plus
Obama.
Five.
Obama. I want to sit down with Obama.
He's on everybody list.
This one's going to trip you out, but I want to sit down with Trump.
wow. I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, bro. Like, you don't think that'd be an interesting conversation? Like,
absolutely. Absolutely. So,
He's interesting. I met Hov before, but like, he's up there. Like, I respect how he move. There ain't too many people that really, you know, excite me outside of what they do. I just love how he's paving the way. So we got Hov there. Number four, I would say, you know, man, I don't even know who would be four. Martin Luther King. I would love to sit down with Martin Luther King. And the last person I would say is, you know, man, let's throw it. I don't know. Who you got, Jack? Who you got? Give me one, Jack.
If I just give you one, I'll give you probably a Mega Evers.
Nice. Okay, cool.
Okay.
All right.
That's a nice, that's a nice little dinner. All right, so last question, and we always have to pre-prep you. If you, the way you answer this last question, if you have access to them, we need your help getting them. Who's one guest you'd want to see on All the Smoke?
Ooh, All the Smoke, one guest.
Drum roll, please. Ring.
Who would be dope? Hov, Jay-Z.
Yeah, that's what we need, talking about, man.
Like, he right there. Is the studio still in L.A.?
Yeah. He's out here. It's just hard to, that's a rich motherfucker. It's just hard to get to him. He's out here, though.
No, Hov, I think Hov, if he hear that clip, Hov would definitely come in because, you know, like, what you're guys are doing. Yeah, for real. Like, what y'all doing, you got to respect the movement. Like, you got to, y'all had Kobe, D-Wade. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got Biden. You got so many. Y'all right there. We need Hov. Hov, we need you.
We need you, Hov.
Oh, we need you. You heard that. And you can bring your wife, too.
Dope, bro.
We can all conversation. Yeah.
All right, let me ask. So, what would be your first question? You get Hov. What's the first question?
I'm just waiting for the begging segment.
What you gonna beg for?
Puma, we need Puma contracts.
We need a Puma sponsor.
Yeah.
My first question would probably be, knowing where you came from, did you ever see yourself becoming a billionaire?
Oh, wow.
I mean, he came from the streets slinging crack, and he's a 50-year-old billionaire now. He's, name another one that's not dead or in prison.
Right.
That's a good question. You know, he would say no. I think he would say, I definitely thought I'd be super successful, but billionaire, who grows up from the hood saying I'm going to be a billionaire? Well, now the kids might say that, but not back then.
Yeah.
That's a good question. I would like to hear his answer.
Yeah. Well, man, thank you, Brandon. We appreciate it. We apologize that we had to cancel on you last week, but we had to get some things done. But, man, thank you for your time. Best of luck with everything you're doing. Me and Jack are ready to come on your show whenever you need us, so let us know, bro.
Oh, bet. Appreciate it.
Right. Man, appreciate you, bro.
That's a wrap. Another episode of All the Smoke with our guest, Brandon Marshall. You can catch this on Showtime Basketball YouTube or the iHeart platform, Black Effects. We'll see y'all next time.
This is All the Smoke, a production of The Black Effect and iHeartRadio in partnership with Showtime.